Hello and welcome to Volume 72 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll discuss the policy debate going on with carbon dioxide emissions. We'll learn about plans to promote a power plant fueled by biomass. We'll see what effect a lawsuit filed in U.S. District Court could have on your property taxes. And we'll discuss the current status of the well-loved polar bear. I'm Hayes Brown, the General Counsel of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. You probably know by now that the polar bear was listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. The polar bear, like the bald eagle, is a charismatic animal with which many people identify. How wide will the effect be of the listing of the polar bear? Our first guest, Reed Hopper, with the Pacific Legal Institute, can explain. Welcome, Reed.
Thank you.
The press reports that during this century, two-thirds of the polar bear population will be lost if present trends continue. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't agree with that. And furthermore, the Department of Interior really doesn't agree with that. The Secretary of Interior has indicated that that claim, that two-thirds of the polar bear being lost by mid-century, is really the guesswork of a single researcher based on subjective evaluations using a model that's a prototype, not final, and shouldn't be relied on. The actual models, climate models that the agency relies on for its listing determination shows that quite the opposite, that by mid-century, three-quarters of the population will survive, even under a worst-case scenario.
Okay. The other things that we've noticed over the years is that there have been a number of species listed as threatened or endangered. I think the list is now up to about 2,000 species. Is the polar bear listing similar? Does it follow a similar pattern, or is it different from others?
Well, yes, it is unique. And you're right, there have been about 2,000 listings nationwide. The polar bear listing is different from all these others in a number of respects. Number one, that's the first time the agency has ever listed a thriving species. The population is now at the highest in recorded history, about 25,000, whereas it was around 5,000 40 or 50 years ago. Secondly, it's the first time a listing has ever occurred where the agency has declared that that the listing will provide no added protection to the species because it cannot address a global warming generally, or melting sea ice in particular. But most importantly, it's unique because it's the first listing of a species that has been based directly on global warming, and that's the real key here.
What impact do you see this having on industrial activity in the U.S.?
What a lot of people don't understand is that when a species is listed under the Endangered Species Act, it triggers a citizen suit provision for suing to challenge any activity that could harm the species. So quite literally, under the Endangered Species Act, when the polar bear was listed, it authorized any person to sue any other person for harming the species, which could be argued would result from any activity which contributes carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So with respect to forestry, cutting trees could be challenged because that would reduce CO2 sequestration. Controlled burns could be challenged because it's putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. The most likely scenario is that forestry activities that require a federal permit of some kind, a 404 dredge and fill permit, or perhaps an NPDES permit, would result in a mitigation being required to address global warming impacts. So those are the possibilities, and the impact nationwide could be quite extreme.
Okay, thank you, Reed. We appreciate you joining us and alerting us to that.
You bet.
In mid-March, the Birmingham News reported about a lawsuit called Lynch versus Alabama. It challenged the Alabama system of property taxation. It looked to us like it could have a negative effect on forest owners, so we asked Chris Isaacson, the Executive Vice President of the Alabama Forestry Association, to comment. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks, Hayes.
Can you give us some more details about the lawsuit?
Sure, I'd be happy to. On March 13th, a class action lawsuit was filed in federal district court in Huntsville on behalf of a group of school children from Sumter and Lawrence counties, alleging that Alabama's property tax revenues failed to adequately fund K-12 public schools, and further that this shortfall unconstitutionally shortchanges black public school students. What this is actually a spinoff of the long-running Knight versus Alabama college desegregation suit. In this current suit, the plaintiffs are arguing that the state's method of funding public schools flows from racially discriminatory property taxes provided for both in the 1901 Constitution and in later amendments to that Constitution.
How does this lawsuit translate to Alabama forest owners?
Well, the best way to see what kind of impact it would have would be to look at our current system. And under our current property tax system, you begin with a value, either fair market or current use, and you apply the assessment ratio based on how the property is classified in order to obtain the assessed value. Then you take the assessed value and multiply it by the millage rate to determine the tax. Now, forest land under our system is Class 3 property and qualifies for current use valuation. To calculate the tax due on forest land, you begin with the current use value, which in Alabama is about an average of $490 per acre, and apply the assessment ratio, which is for Class 3 property, is 10% to obtain the assessed value, which is about $49 per acre. Then you multiply the assessed value by the local millage rate to get the tax due.
Okay, that's how it's currently working, right?
That's how it's currently working.
Right.
Now, under the lawsuit, the plaintiffs are asking the federal courts to eliminate all of Alabama's existing limitations on property tax rates, to do away with this differential assessment, to remove the maximum tax or LID provisions that limit the total amount of property taxes that can be collected, and then finally to eliminate a number of constitutionally provided for exemptions, such as those that exempt property held for religious or charitable purposes. Now, if they were granted this relief that they're asking for, if they're successful, forest land would be assessed at 100% of full market value, not 10% of current use value. What this means would be about a 1,000% increase of taxes on forest land due to the elimination of the differential assessment, plus any increase that might be due to the loss of current use valuation. Now, if you happen to own land in Shelby, Madison, Baldwin, or any other county near rapidly growing metropolitan area, you could be looking at a moving from $490 an acre to $5,000 to $10,000 an acre of value. And it doesn't take an Auburn graduate to figure out that this could have a huge impact on landowners and land use.
This doesn't look like good news. What should landowners be doing about it?
Well, probably most of us remember the hard-fought Amendment 1 battle we had back in 2003 that would have doubled property taxes for most landowners. This lawsuit is Amendment 1 on steroids. It is, however, not going to be waged with marketing consultants developing advertisements and commercials like the Amendment 1 battle was. It'll be waged with attorneys producing research and legal briefs. At the Forestry Association, we're in the process of building a coalition of like-minded groups and individuals, and that coalition's likely going to be anchored by the same groups that fought Amendment 1, plus others who'd be impacted. Hayes, probably the best thing I can do to tell folks that are interested in just keeping up with what's going on is to send them to our website at www.alaforestry.org. And click on property tax lawsuit. And what we'll do is use that as an opportunity to keep everybody informed. And on that page, they can download copies of all the legal filings as well as a brief synopsis of the lawsuit.
All right. Well, Chris, thank you for that. We appreciate you keeping us informed. Thank you very much. George Will commented recently that environmentalists have succeeded in demonizing as a global menace a substance that's found in almost everything. That's carbon. We've decided to ask Marty McElhaney, who edits the Liberty Matters newsletter, to comment on a phenomenon known as cap and trade. Welcome, Marty.
I'm here. How are you?
Tell us about Liberty Matters and the email newsletter that you edit.
Liberty Matters is a newsletter that we send out to our subscribers bi-weekly or so. It deals with subjects such as endangered species, government intrusion on property rights and private rights, eminent domain, property rights issues, just a whole scheme of things, from the ridiculous to the sublime in some cases.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us a little bit about this term that we've been hearing about, cap and trade, as it pertains to CO2 emissions.
Cap and trade is a very, very complex issue. I don't even understand the whole thing of it, but essentially what it is, the government tells industries how much carbon dioxide they can emit in an effort to reduce global warming or whatever it is they're trying to achieve.
Okay, that's the cap part.
That's the cap.
Okay.
And if these industries are have too much emissions and cannot reach they're over the goals, then they're able to buy allowances from other industries whose emissions are below the threshold, and that's trade.
Okay. There was a bill recently called the Climate Security Act, and it would have, the goal, I think, was to dramatically reduce CO2 emissions. What happened with that, and what were the effects on the economy had it passed?
S-3036 was filibustered to death on June 6th. A few hardy Republicans gathered their courage and blocked the cloture vote on it.
Mm-hmm.
It would have caused Americans to be forced to pay much, much more in energy costs, costs for food, costs for gasoline, costs for gas, electricity. And the Congressional Budget Office estimated that this bill, S-3036, would increase taxes by $1 trillion over the next 10 years. A tremendous amount that just, it would destroy the American economy if it is allowed to be brought into,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, whatever.
Defeated this time. We'll keep an eye out for it, then call
yes,
the Congress.
It'll be back, mm-hmm. because whoever is elected president, therefore, McCain said, sent a letter saying that he would have voted for it had he been in the Senate,
mm-hmm.
that day. And Obama is for it, and since there is a likelihood that the Democrats will be taking over the Senate and the House next year, this thing will be back, and it will probably be passed.
All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on that, Marty. Thank you for alerting us to that. We appreciate it. Tom Canelio is helping the city of Gainesville, Florida, assess the feasibility of building a power plant that uses biofuel, including logging waste and pulpwood-sized trees. So we've invited him to discuss the process the city is taking to look at this new technology. Hello, Tom.
Hey, Hayes. Thank you for having me.
Anytime a city's involved, there are always political obstacles to a program. What are the political obstacles to getting this plant built?
Well, the political obstacles in our case in North Central Florida were getting involved early as just plain old citizens when we saw the price of natural gas going up, and we knew that Gainesville was going to need more power down the road. We got them to hire us to do a study, and we found a lot of waste wood within 25 miles of our municipally owned power plant, about 60 megawatts worth, and we worked hard in a coalition with folks to stop a coal plant that was going to be built. Charlie Crist, our Republican governor, saw the handwriting on the wall and stopped coal plants all over the state. So we're actually ahead of the game. The other aspect of the political obstacle is the political cultural obstacle, as I define it, which is to understand that forestry producers need to consider the fact that down here we're not going to build a pulp mill to supply electricity. Therefore, we have to have dry wood, as dry as possible.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell us something about the technical aspects of this plant, which uses biofuel. Are there any hurdles that y'all are overcoming?
Well, size is going to be interesting, because the contract that is being negotiated right now with a company called Nacogdoches Power LLC out of Boston is 100 megawatts, and it'll be one of the largest wood-fired power plants in the country. They, technologically speaking, they are going to have to figure out how to get the logging debris, which is about 50% of the supply it's been defined by the School of Forestry down here, University of Florida, almost 50%. We're figure out how to get it to the plant efficiently and as cheaply as possible, which is why we've undertaken a research project with U.S. Forest Service to up in Alabama, as a matter of fact, to study the John Deere Energy Harvester this fall and next year.
Do you think this is economically feasible?
I do, because the supply is out there, and 70% of it will be waste wood. We'll have to go out maybe 50 miles from the site, our power plant site, and we're only worried now about the cost of diesel, which is why our council, our RC&D council, is working on synthetic diesel from wood, and one of our corporate sponsors.
Okay. Well, thanks, Tom. We appreciate you joining us and letting us know about that.
Thank you, Hayes.
Our next guest, John Berry, is a forestry specialist with the Arkansas Cooperative Extension Service. He's interested in using food plots to promote wildlife, but not just any type plant suits him. He wants to show us how native plants are the preferred alternative. He can explain. Welcome, John. Native food plots, that's a term I haven't heard before. What is that?
Well, the term may be a little deceptive, but we've had a hard time coming up with a good name for our idea. A native food plot could be something that looks like a traditional food plot, except instead of using the traditional seed mixes that hunters have been planting, they use mixes of native seeds. At the other end of the spectrum, a native food plot may be something as simple as a landowner going out on his property, finding existing native vegetation and just managing that. It may not even look like a food plot at all. The best choice is going to depend on several factors. It will depend on how much money the landowner wants to spend, depend on what kind of vegetation he already has there, so whether he's got good native forage that the wildlife will use or not. It depends on the soils that he has. He'll have to look at the soil and see whether it's a fertile soil or not. It'll also depend on the kind of wildlife that landowner wants to attract. You'll have to look at all four of those things and make a decision about what kind of native food plot is best for him.
Well, since fertilizer costs are so high with lime and seed and so forth, is it still a good bet to put out a native plant as opposed to some of these other plants that we're more commonly using?
Well, I think it has always been a good choice, and with the cost of fuel and fertilizer, I think it's becoming an even better choice. Most of the native food plots, the way they would be managed, takes less fuel, less fertilizer than the traditional food plots. And the landowner would not be going out and plowing every year and applying fertilizer every year. Of course, those things are expensive. But a landowner can look at it from two points of view. He can reduce the cost of producing all this native forage or wildlife forage by using the native plants, or he can put the same amount of money into it and produce more forage. So it gives landowners some good options, some choices to make.
Give us an idea of native plants to see if we recognize any of their names.
Okay. Well, it depends on the wildlife you want to raise, you want on your site. If you're growing, if you want to see quail, native grasses are good. A lot of the traditional pasture grasses are turf grasses, and the quail just don't deal well with those. But the native grasses, the ones we have, are bunch grasses. Quail seem to deal with bunch grasses a lot better. So native grasses are good. Beggar's lice are good for quail. Some of the native Lespedezas, and note that Korean Lespedeza is not a native Lespedeza. Those things could be managed by prescribed burning, which works really well. If you're interested in deer, oaks are some of the good native plants for deer, and those can be maintained as shrubs by either mowing frequently or burning every few years. Again, beggar's lice is a good one for deer, and the Lespedezas. Also, ragweeds and the greenbriars are a good forage for deer, which those are things that most people probably have never thought of as managing those plants as forage.
Mm-hmm. That's all for John. We appreciate it very much. One of the most important things about your forest land is also one of the most overlooked, and I'd wager that only 1 in 100 forest owners knows the soil type of his forest, but that's one aspect that determines the inherent productivity of your site. So how do you find out what soil type you have? Chris Irwin with Forest Assist has some technology that can help you get started on that process. Hello, Chris.
Hello, how are you?
How do you get started in finding your soil type using your technology?
Well, the Forest Assist program is basically designed to help all forest landowners become informed about their soil and their property as well. The first aspect to consider is getting onto the Internet, and that is the website will be posted on your website today.
Right.
And then to click on Profile Your Land. This is a sidebar. Once you do that, then you'll be given a map of the United States, and you locate your property. Each state is divided by the counties. Click on the county, any county, wherever it's located, and using the Google Maps program that's embedded in the Forest Assist site, you will be given an opportunity to find your property. So that's the first step, is finding your property using the map.
Okay.
And once you're there, you will be given the opportunity to select any area of interest using the USDA NRCS Soil Web Survey.
And so that overlays the property map that you're seeing and lets you identify your soil type?
That's correct. Once you do outline your property, then you will actually be given the chance to see then the soil that you have, and this is something that the NRCS website provides.
Mm-hmm.
It's outside our website, so I have no control over how it operates.
Have you experienced people who have had problems or pitfalls along the way that you can help them avoid?
Yes. The biggest concern is the connectivity of your computer.
Mm-hmm.
As always, the speed of which you're connected to the Internet will make a big difference, because the file from the NRCS Soil Web Survey is fairly large.
Mm-hmm. Once you have the soil map, you've identified it, how do you use the map then to make management decisions?
That's a great discussion point, because as a landowner, most people don't have the technical knowledge to understand soils and the connections to site index. Working with a professional resource manager, a forester, a wildlife biologist, these professionals will be the key to helping a landowner understand what their soils are all about, how to match soil type with species of interest to grow, either for timber or wildlife.
Okay. Well, that was Chris Irwin highlighting the technology called Forest Assist. Thank you, Chris. We appreciate you joining us.
Thank you.
Our final guest is Martin Copping, and he's with a company called GeoVisus, and he's familiar with the Global Information Systems, or GIS, that we've heard about and that have application to forest landowners. Welcome, Martin.
Thanks for having me, Hayes.
Tell me about the services and solutions that your company offers.
GeoVisus offers web GIS solutions and GIS management services. One of our biggest philosophies is offering software as a service. So instead of having the customer needing to purchase expensive software, this service basically has it in a hosted environment where through your web browser, internet connection, you're able to log on to a web service and be able to access all your property information, make management decisions. And then, of course, we offer both remote and on-site services where we can kind of help you build your system. And, of course, these are all done very cost-effectively.
So instead of buying software, having it delivered to you, you're hosting the software and you simply go to that site and
correct.
Use it.
Correct. The client simply uses our license of the software. They would subscribe to the service. It's pretty cost-effective. And they don't. Nice thing is, it's simple and it's easy to use. They don't have to be a GIS guru mm-hmm. to be able to have a map of their property and overlay soil types, etc.
You're giving a seminar demonstrating. It's on July 23rd, giving a demonstration session on GIS Lite. Can
That's
you tell
correct.
Us about that?
Sure. GIS Lite is our flagship product. This is our main software as a service. It's a very simple, scalable map management tool. It's built on ESRI's ArcGIS server technology, and what that allows the user to have is an environment where, through a web browser, they can store and access information, whether it's maps or data. They can also share this information with, say, other landowners. They can use it for management decisions. They can use it for analysis. For instance, they want to know property value information or what sort of trees can I grow on my property. They could simply ask the right questions of the data through a very intuitive interface, and it would give them a graphical answer.
What would you say to someone who doesn't see themselves as being able to use GIS? Is this a difficult thing to learn how to do?
Well, GIS has always been nerds in a back room, mm-hmm. and you had to be a genius to figure it out. And, of course, with a lot of the breakthroughs that we've had in recent years, especially from ESRI's technology, GIS is becoming a lot more accessible. In fact, we use GIS every day without realizing it. That's what Google Earth is. It's a geographical information system. You want to get directions from your home to the nearest Walmart. That's a GIS in action. Mm-hmm. And so GIS is becoming a lot more cost-effective by using, say, for instance, our GIS Lite solution, which is a hosted solution. And it's on the web, so it's a lot easier to use. There's no complex software to have to learn anymore.
Okay. Mark, we appreciate that. And that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Reed Hopper, Chris Isaacson, Marty McElhaney, and Tom Coniglio. We also appreciate the contributions of John Berry, Chris Irwin, and Martin Copping. We've discussed a wide variety of topics today, from polar bears to carbon dioxide to biofuels and new technologies. Most of these things are important issues now, but as important as they did not exist 20 years ago when you planted your now 20-year-old trees. That's the challenge of forest ownership, to decide what you will harvest in 20 to 30 years. It requires a certain degree of optimism and faith that the decisions you make today will make you look good in the future. These are qualities most forest owners have a surplus of, faith in the future and optimism, and that's one thing that won't change. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown. Thank you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.